I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Heroin-related deaths and addiction are on the rise, and the profile of the new user is different from what it used to be, older, whiter, and less urban. Also on the rise are deaths and addiction related to the abuse of prescription narcotics, mostly painkillers, that have increasingly become a gateway drug for heroin addicts. This is pretty much true across the country, including here in Pennsylvania and across the river in New Jersey, where each state has taken a different approach to the problem. For instance, New Jersey residents can call 911 to report an overdose without fear of arrest. Not so the Commonwealth. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you as we examine heroin policy in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, also usage in the region and potential solutions. Roseanne Scotti is the Drug Policy Alliance's state director in New Jersey. Roseanne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us, Noni West. She's public policy and family program specialist for the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. And Noni West, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Let me put some basic stuff on the table before we get into things like policy. And Roseanne, I'll start with you. Why is heroin on the rise? And do we know how much it is on the rise?
Well, we don't totally know how much it is on the rise. We do know that there's an increase. We know that drugs go in cycles, all drugs, and so it does seem to be at a point where it is more popular, particularly among particular populations. And we know that some of what we've done in terms of attempting to reduce prescription opioid abuse has actually helped fuel this. A lot of the crackdowns on trying to get less prescribing of opioids and pain clinics and things like that actually had the unintended consequence of moving people towards heroin. And so I think it's a very nuanced situation and a situation that really calls out for a public health approach.
And I want to pick up on that. Noni, you work in Bucks County. Help us understand what we're talking about when we're talking about heroin use in Bucks County.
Well, what's happening in Bucks County, actually, is that we've sort of been buffered from the heroin and opioid overdose epidemic because it really was pretty much concentrated more in western Pennsylvania or in Philadelphia. But what's happening now is that the overdoses are becoming more obvious and more frequent, concentrating more in the sort of southern part of the county. It's closer
to
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
But actually, I'm a Doylestown resident, and we have had several overdoses in Doylestown at Christmas time in Newtown and Warrington. So the public is starting to become very much aware of it, and parents are concerned. We had we've had several community. Penn Foundation has organized community meetings, and there have been 250, 300, 400 parents showing up, depending upon where they are. The Intelligencer, I think, had 400 parents show.
So a lot of interest and obvious concern.
Concern, very big concern.
Is it easy to get heroin around here, Roseanne?
In Philadelphia?
This region, yeah?
Yes. It is. It has become, heroin today is pure and more available than ever before, despite 40 years of the drug war, what we would call the failed drug war, which, again, I think shows the limitations of approaching this from a criminal justice perspective. If that worked, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in today.
And is it a crisis that we're in today? Do you see it that way?
You have to be, I always like to be careful about calling it a crisis or an epidemic. I mean, when you talk about epidemics, that is a term of art in terms of public health issues. Whatever the situation is, what we do know is there's an increase in overdose deaths. They have tripled nationally in the last decade or two in this country. And so whatever the basic numbers are, we need to do something, and some of the things that need to happen, you know, we know what's effective, like Good Samaritan laws and access to naloxone, and we need to be moving forward with that.
Is there, though, a connection, I kind of said this in my introduction, between heroin use and prescription drugs for things like pain prescription drugs? Is there a connection there, Noni?
Well, absolutely, because they're opioids. And so,
same drug, one's legal,
yes.
One's illegal.
And what's happened is that the opioids, the oxycodone, have been very available as painkillers. And actually, most of the getting the people who do get them out of the medicine cabinet. So it's young, and what happens is it's very expensive. When people start to buy it on the street, it's $30-$35 a pill. Heroin can be a third of that, or less than a third of that. And so for people who become addicted, they turn to heroin because it's less expensive.
Is it the same experience for them? Do they get the same high off of these two drugs?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. They experience a form of euphoria that they like. I don't know that heroin is exactly the same as painkiller.
Do you?
I would say they're very similar. It's an opioid effect. I think one of the things to consider when you're looking at what difference in experiences there might be, if someone's getting a prescription opioid, they at least know what's in that prescription opioid. Right. When you're buying heroin on the street, it could be cut with fentanyl. It could be cut with all sorts of things. And so you just don't know what you're getting because it is an illegal and unregulated market.
And we heard about the fentanyl, I guess the overdoses of heroin laced with fentanyl. You're saying that was a problem not anymore in western Pennsylvania, at least, than in eastern Pennsylvania.
Yes, it has. If you look at maps, like 5 years ago, the overdose was more in the Pittsburgh area and west and north. But now, and when you look at the concentrations, it's moved into, and perhaps Philadelphia, but now it's moved into the suburbs and other areas are a lot more north, south.
You had mentioned the Good Samaritan laws. New Jersey has a Good Samaritan law. What is it and how does it work?
We do indeed have a Good Samaritan law. We've had one for a little over a year now. Governor Christie signed it a little over a year ago. And what it does, it protects someone who calls 911 or the people with them, which is important, from being arrested for drug possession or paraphernalia possession or any violation of parole or probation. People very often use drugs together, and so someone may be in a position to call for help because when someone overdoses, they often will not die for an hour to 3 hours. So there's time to get help. And, you know, these are not people who have large amounts of drugs. There's people who may have small amounts of drugs they were using together. And so what we're saying is that calling 911 should never be a crime, and saving a life should always take priority over punishing behavior. And that's our position now in New Jersey. You do the right thing, you save a life, you're not getting arrested.
And has, you said it's been about a year. Has it worked? Is there any way to know if it is working?
It's too early to know in terms of any kind of statistics, but certainly anecdotally, we're hearing a lot about people not being afraid to call 911. This is a law that has been embraced, I will say, by law enforcement, who have been very helpful, and I think that's one of the differences with Pennsylvania, in getting the word out. The Attorney General had a very visible press conference and issued guidance on the law, where he encouraged law enforcement to construe the law very liberally in terms of not arresting people, and said, you know, the goal here is to save lives. And so I think that's been a very powerful message.
Noni, where does that stand in Pennsylvania, a Good Samaritan law? Or does it?
Well, it does. I mean, there is no Good Samaritan law at this point. There have been several laws introduced in the legislature, one by Senator Pledgey, and I think there have been several versions introduced. Maybe November, December of last year. And then Senator Pledgey's has been around for a while. I think there was one other. And then Representatives Jean DiGirolamo and Representative Frankel from Pittsburgh worked together to craft another Good Samaritan law that included the expanded distribution of naloxone. And that happened sort of about March of this year. So now what is happening in the legislature is there's sort of been a merger and an amalgamation so that it can coalesce into one bill. And that is under Senator Pledgey at this point, and I believe it's Senate Bill 1166.
And do you think that will make it through the legislature and to the governor?
It just went through the stages of having an amendment so that users and family members. It's 1164.
There you
Thank
go.
You.
Thank you.
Can have access also, because most over 80% of overdoses are seen by other users. Right. So getting naloxone expanded beyond just the emergency personnel is a good thing. And that amendment went through right before the budget, which hasn't really gone through yet. So that's where we stand. And I was hoping to hear this morning when it's expected to come back to the floor for full vote. So it's been a slower process than we would like to see, and certainly not as embraced as things were in New Jersey.
And why do you think that is?
I think there's a combination of reasons. In New Jersey, right now, looking at it from a consumer point of view,
sure.
I believe that New Jersey had the Drug Policy Alliance to help organize. We have a lot of community coalitions working. In Pennsylvania, the Casey's Cause is very, very active in Chester County. Gary Tennis in Harrisburg has a coalition. We actually have an opioid overdose, but we're not sort of working together and having one voice where we're speaking to all our legislators. And I think in that case, New Jersey was much different.
Would you agree with that, Roseanne? That there was more either consensus on the issue or someone spearheading it?
Yeah, you know, we definitely were in a better position in that we do have an office in Trenton. So we're two blocks from the State House. We were able to organize particularly parents all across the state who were a very, very powerful voice. Many of them had lost children to overdose. But we also had public health groups and we had faith leaders. And so that was a huge help in speaking as one voice and getting the message out to our legislature and ultimately to Governor Christie that this had support and this needed to pass in New Jersey.
And we're almost up in a break here. Was Governor Christie amenable to the Good Samaritan law?
In the end, he was. He did veto. He vetoed the bill when it first got to his desk, but we did not give up because we never give up. And we came back actually with our naloxone bill. And during that time, Governor Christie rethought his position and eventually signed the naloxone and Good Samaritan bill together.
Well, I do want to take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation and also talk a bit more about naloxone. That's Roseanne Scotti, and she's the Drug Policy Alliance's state director in New Jersey. Also with us, Noni West, public policy and family program specialist for the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. And we are talking about the problem of heroin use in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey. The states have taken different approaches to the problem, and that's what we're talking about as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. Graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more.
What makes an album a classic? Is it the songwriting? I can't disguise the pounding of my heart. It beats so strong. Is it the melody? Is it the innovation? For Prince's 1984 movie soundtrack, it's all of that and more.
Join Jim DeRogatis and me, Greg Kot, for this week's Sound Opinions as we do a classic album dissection on Prince's Purple Rain.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. There are now thousands of little free libraries, small as birdhouses. Anyone can take books from them. But a 9-year-old from Kansas is now fighting officials who said he had to take his down.
It benefits reading. And as my mom said, it really benefits the community.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about heroin use in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey. Again, talking with Roseanne Scotti and Noni West. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think should be done about the problem of heroin use? You both talked about naloxone right before the break, and I want to make sure our listeners know what we're talking about. Roseanne, if I can go back to you. What's naloxone?
Naloxone is, and it basically is a drug that reverses the effects of an opioid overdose. It basically attaches to the neuroreceptors in the brain that opioids would attach to and displaces them. It's what an EMT would give to someone if they overdosed, and there is now movement across the country to get that into more people's hands who might be witness an overdose.
Well, and I'm assuming that's Ian, emergency responders, what, family, friends, police?
Absolutely, and peers. I think it's very important when we talk about first responders to remember that the first responders in the majority of cases are the person the individual is using drugs with, and they're the ones who immediately can give the person naloxone. It can be injected into a muscle or used as a nasal spray. It's very simple to use, but also having family members. We actually, just a couple months ago, had a mother in New Jersey who had gotten naloxone at one of the naloxone trainings done by South Jersey AIDS Alliance, who found her daughter unconscious at home and gave her naloxone and saved her life.
Wow.
And we also do want police and EMTs to have that, but it's very important to remember that peers are really often the real first responders.
But do you have to be medically trained to use it, or is it pretty simple to use?
It is very, very simple to use. You just ascertain that the person is having an overdose. There are some very simple ways to do that. Do some rescue breathing, call 911, and then you can, with the nasal spray, you spray it up each nostril. And for people who have seen this, and there's some videos online that people can look at, it's rather amazing. It brings the person back really, really quickly. And for the individuals doing it is often a rather transformative experience to be in that position and save a life like that.
To bring someone back to life.
Absolutely.
Back to you, Noni. Wes, where does naloxone stand in Pennsylvania?
Well, actually, the law is not passed, but the as I understand, the enforcement, getting it into the hands of emergency personnel is accepted by everybody. The amendment to get it into the hands of family members and users was a little bit more questionable, but that has been passed. The amendment has been passed on the House floor, and now it has to go to full vote.
And concern by getting it into the hands of friends or peers, there was concern that that would be abused or misused somehow?
Yeah, and I think that there's, I think it's also an education process. When you understand that an overdose can happen in your own home, if you're parents, and a lot of parents know that their children are using. For the family program, we have almost, which is a far cry from 5 years ago, anywhere from 80 to 100% of the parents coming to our family program are for 15 to 23-year-olds using heroin.
15 to 23?
Yes. And so when those parents know, and we had one family who came home and their son was unconscious with a needle in his arm on the chair in the living room, if they have Narcan, they can reverse the overdose. But I think that there needs to be a lot of education about that subject.
Well, and both of you have given examples of parents knowing that their children are heroin users or perhaps even heroin addicts. What are the signs that a child or someone you know, Roseanne, is addicted to heroin? What should people look for? I mean, there's the image of someone nodding out on a street corner, but I think it's more complicated than that.
Indeed, it is. And, you know, there's certainly, you know, you could look at some classic changes in behavior, you know, with a young person in terms of attitude changes and, you know, slipping in terms of grades in school and things like that. I think one of the important things to remember, though, is you might not necessarily
really
know. Some parents know because the child has maybe been in treatment and gotten out and relapsed. But one of the things that's not clear is how much the people, in terms of the overdoses that are happening today, are they overdoses that are happening to people who are using opioids in a long term where a family member might know about the situation? Or has it simply become, you know, for some population, a drug that they use at a party, especially if they use it in conjunction with alcohol, which is very, very bad, or benzodiazepines? You know, it could be the first time the person ever used heroin. And so, you know, again, having as much access as possible in terms of families, in terms of police, in terms of EMTs is really the important message.
And I do want to get to our callers. To you, Noni, I mean, what we're talking about is multiple uses, I guess, of different kinds of drugs.
Yes, absolutely. And I think Rose brings up a really good point that this is not necessarily, all these situations are not an issue of addiction. It's just because it is more acceptable. There are party, I guess they're called farm parties, where there's just a bowl of medications and people are using them randomly. There isn't a stigma about using a needle as there used to be a stigma about using needles. So the things have changed and people can be experimenting, and because of what is happening, that people do not know what is in the heroin, or they may have taken too many prescription drugs with alcohol.
Something terrible can
Something happens, can and you know, totally unintended. So it's not necessarily an addiction issue at this point. It is a social and a health issue.
But what I hear you both saying, perhaps this is a change, which is more states, or certainly New Jersey, taking a more public health approach to the issue of drug use or addiction.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that's been very encouraging for us that is that for the most part, and there are exceptions, the response to this situation has been very much a public health response. Often in the past, when, you know, you saw negative effects related to certain drugs, if you look back at crack cocaine or methamphetamine, when it was in the news a lot, the response was to increase criminal penalties and to arrest more people and to build more prisons. And, you know, at this point, people understand that that's a failed philosophy and we don't need to go down that road.
Nor can we afford it.
Nor can we afford it, especially, you know, in New Jersey, half the adults who do want drug treatment can't get it because of lack of capacity and lack of funding. And so we really need to be putting our scarce resources into a public health approach to this problem.
Well, we are talking about heroin use here in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey. Again, that's Roseanne Scotti, and she's the Drug Policy Alliance's state director in New Jersey. Also with us, Noni West. She's Public Policy and Family Program Specialist for the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We also take emails here on Radio Times, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think the policy about heroin use should be? Let me get Dana to join us. Dana from Haddon Township. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times, Dana.
Hi, thanks,
there.
Marty. I have some questions just for my own edification about methadone and methadone clinics. My husband's office is about a block away from one in downtown Camden, and there's always this long line outside. And I want to understand, what is methadone? Who pays for it? Is that a taxpayer-funded process and service? And what is the goal? Is it to wean addicts off of heroin, or is it just to maintain them? And I mainly ask because one of the things that concerns me, and I'm a politically progressive person, but I do feel frustrated at the notion that there are individuals whose addictions are not only rendering them unable to work, so therefore they are collecting disability, but then they are also potentially getting a taxpayer-funded drug that is just sustaining their existing addiction. So if your experts could sort of clarify that, that would be great.
Dana, I appreciate the call to Radio Times since she's calling from Manhattan Township. Can I toss that first to you, Roseanne?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the first thing to be said is that, you know, methadone is a wonderful drug. It is the gold standard in terms of opioid addiction. It's not for everyone, but for many people, it is actually the drug that helps them stabilize their lives, work, take care of their families. And so it does, you know, if there's concerns that, it, you know, people are, you know, people really don't get disability anymore for substance abuse. At one time in this country, that did happen. So, and sometimes it's paid for out of insurance, sometimes it's paid for out of pocket, sometimes it can be paid for out of Medicaid. But it is something that really helps people stabilize their lives and, you know, get back to being productive members of society.
So they don't become methadone addicts, per se?
Well, I think, again, the thing to remember about addiction is, you know, addiction is a chronic condition. It's not like appendicitis. It's not like, you know, you have your appendix out and you're fixed. It's, you know, been compared to by very prominent addiction experts like Tom McClellan here at the University of Pennsylvania as, you know, much more similar to diabetes or to heart disease. And indeed, for some people, they may have to use that for the rest of their lives, just the way some people will have to use diabetes medications for the rest of their lives. That is not a bad thing. Some people get weaned off. For some people, it's what helps them maintain a positive life.
But what I hear you saying is that they can have a positive life. They can hold a job. They can raise a family. They can be a responsible parent. I mean, all that, and also be at a methadone clinic.
Absolutely.
Noni, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that it's called, the whole category is medication-assisted recovery. And the to understanding that addiction is can be a genetic disease, and it's a condition that one does not get over, when you realize that a person, if it assists them into being a functioning person that can deal with their family life and contribute to the community and be a taxpayer because they can earn an income, then medication-assisted recovery is a very good thing. And some people actually cannot function without it.
Dana, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What are some effective treatments? So you talked about the fact that if we have this more public health, mental health approach to addiction, what works with treatment? And this is a complicated disease that somebody has.
That's a very complicated question. Certainly methadone is very effective, especially for long-term opioid addiction. There are other medications like Suboxone, which are particularly indicated for younger people because they are easier for someone to wean off of if that's what they want. I think a thing to remember, a lot of individuals who have substance abuse problems are dual diagnosed. They may also have mental health issues. There's lots of evidence that for people who are suffering from depression, being on antidepressants helps them with their recovery and helps them, you know, maintain recovery and maintain abstinence if that's what they're looking for. And so it really is a very holistic situation, and there's, lots of ways to approach it.
Is it residential treatment? Is it outpatient treatment? Is it AA, RNA?
There are many pathways to recovery. And treatment is one component of recovery. And what we at the council and PROACT, what we say is that we don't want to get people into treatment. We want to get them into recovery. And what we want to do is help them to sustain long-term recovery. So particularly in looking at the heroin overdose situation, our point of view is what we want to do is to get people assessed, especially people who have experienced an overdose. At that point in time, give them an assessment, find out whether this really is an addiction issue or whether it was a dalliance, an unfortunate dalliance with the drug, and then get the people on the right path to recovery. There are many, many... PROACT actually has peer specialists, and that is a very effective way for people to start to enter recovery because there are people with lived experience. And at that point, people can determine what they want to do with the rest of their life. Is this path working for them? Do they need to go to treatment? There's a Smart Recovery is another program that is coming up that is a little bit different from the traditional AA. There are dual diagnosis help groups. There are help groups for families. It is very important for the family to be part of recovery. So as Rose said, this is a very complex issue. There is not just one answer.
Let me get George from Norristown to join our conversation. George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'd like to talk about Suboxone for a second, just because I had I have a company, and I had hired a commercial driver. He filled out his paperwork, said he had no medication that he was taking. And after about a month of employment, I had a phone call of someone that was following him, said he was all over the road. And I talked to him when he got back to work. He said he just didn't know what I was talking about. And I had another phone call, and then one day he was following me home, and he ran over a crosswalk sign.
Wow.
Each incident, well, prior to hiring him, I had sent him for a DOT four panel test, which is required. He passed that. After each incident, I had, or complaint, I had sent him for the four or five panel. Two more times. The last time I sent him for a 10 panel, passed every time. The last time, when he had ran over the crosswalk, I had fired him. And the day I fired him, he said he admitted to that point he was on Suboxone. And what he was doing was, since it's a self-medicated, you put it under your tongue, he wasn't taking it for a few days, and he would take a whole bunch one day.
Hmm.
And I guess my issue is, you know, we have people that aren't required to put it down that legally. Well, he's collecting unemployment now because the state, since there was no accident report or police report, I'm now paying for him as, for unemployment. I guess I have an issue with the fact that we have these people that are driving possibly commercial vehicles of 80,000 pounds driving down the road high that no one can really do anything about. Even the police, when they do a test, they really don't know much about the Suboxone medication. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are on that.
George, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Another complicated issue. Do you mind? I'm going to toss that first to you, Roseanne. Go ahead.
Sure, absolutely. I think the thing to remember here is that any medication can be irresponsibly used. It can be abused. I think if someone, again, didn't take their diabetes medicine for several days and then took a large amount of it, they might have some reactions that would put them in a position where they might not be able to shouldn't be driving. So this is not something that is limited to Suboxone. Suboxone, again, is a medication that has helped millions of people, help them to, maintain employment and make positive change in their lives. And, one question would be whether this individual was actually under the care of a doctor, whether he had access to real treatment. There's certainly some people who use Suboxone, to wean themselves off drugs because they can't get into treatment. They buy it on the streets. And the problem isn't the Suboxone. The problem is the lack of adequate effective treatment.
But we're almost up in a break here. What I hear George saying is, I was the boss, and I didn't know I had an employee that sounds like misusing this particular drug. Any thoughts, Nani?
Well, I think some people, and we've run into that in the family program. Parents come in and tell us that their children are doing Suboxone sort of on their own, or they're doing it with the doctor and they know nothing about it. I mean, methadone and Suboxone should all be done under medical
doctor's care.
But a lot of people think, well, I can do it myself, because they really aren't committed to getting themselves in recovery and think that they can do a short corner there. So it has nothing to do with Suboxone or methadone, I think, what the caller is calling about.
It's more
it can
to
happen
with
elsewhere.
The person themselves, it sounds
yes.
like. George, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about heroin use in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Noni West, Roseanne Scotti, our guests. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
The movies Next Stop Greenwich Village, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Bloom in Love, Harry and Tonto, Moscow on the Hudson, and An Unmarried Woman were directed by Paul Mazursky. He died June 30th at the age of 84. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to excerpts of the interviews we recorded in 1991 and 99. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Every year, 1.5 million children in the United States experience their parents' divorce. Well, most parents are very worried about their kids' mental health as they go through this process and want to protect their children from the fallout. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll take a look at the real impact of divorce on our children. today at noon here on WHYY FM.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about heroin use here in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. It is on the rise, like in other states across the country. A number of causes, including the cheap price and availability of the drug. There's also the issue, the problem of the availability of prescription pain medicine that has become a gateway drug to heroin for some people. We're talking about heroin use and treatment. And again, Roseanne Scotti, our guest, she's the Drug Policy Alliance's state director. In New Jersey, Noni West is a public policy and family program specialist for the Council on Southeast Pennsylvania. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, we have an email from Nick saying, what prevents a heroin user, in quotation marks, from becoming a heroin addict? And you were talking briefly about, I tossed this question to you during the break. Noni, go ahead.
You can be a casual heroin user. It's very much the same. Alcohol is a drug as well. There are some people who can drink a glass of wine and that will be it for them in a meal. And there are some people who cannot become just a casual wine or alcohol drinker. And that's why they have to stop. So it's very much, same. It just depends upon how the body's receptors receive the chemical.
Anything you want to add to that, Roseanne?
Yeah, I just that, you know, the majority of people who use heroin or any other drug do not become dependent on it. Between like 10 and 25% of individuals who use various drugs will go on to have what would be considered, an abuse situation, a dependent situation. But most people who use drugs actually don't become dependent.
Oh, interesting. We have another caller actually concerned about the use of the word doing methadone. We don't say people with diabetes do the drug treatment they're in. You're nodding your head, Roseanne. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And if I was the one who talked about doing methadone, I apologize. Indeed, we shouldn't use that term. People who are taking methadone or for their addiction, we should talk about it in exactly the same way that we talk about someone who's taking medication for heart disease or hypertension or diabetes.
Let me get Andrea from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Andrea, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I can't help but comment on the fact that when the drug epidemic was focused on crack cocaine and methamphetamines, and largely blacks and poor whites were being affected, the approach was really to incarcerate. And, this entire prison complex grew out of that approach. And your guests have commented on the fact that with the heroin and the prescription drug epidemics, the approach is more around public health and mental health, which, really should have been the case, regardless of the communities that were being impacted. But we see the devastating results that the approach to crack epidemic and methamphetamine has had on so many of our communities. Well, and so I do hope that a different approach is being taken, but it's a sad commentary that the American will was not there to really address crack cocaine and methamphetamine with a public health and a mental health approach.
Andrew, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I think you raised some very good points, and whether it was lessons learned from how the sort of lock 'em up approach to drug addiction, whether we have learned from that, or whether because, Roseanne, we're dealing with maybe a different population, we have a different view of who these users are.
I think your caller makes an excellent, excellent point. I think that one of the things that has moved us to accept a more public health approach in terms of the general population and mainstream elected officials is who is perceived to be impacted currently by heroin use and larger opioid use. I will say there are many dedicated individuals out there who have been working to prevent overdoses in all populations for a long, long time. Prevention Point Philadelphia, Philadelphia's Needle Exchange Program, has been distributing naloxone for many years. Chicago Recovery Alliance, which is Chicago's Needle Exchange Program, began distributing naloxone on their own before there were any laws to, you know, protect anybody or give anybody immunity over a dozen years ago. And so there are indeed many people who cared about this for a long time, and it was a matter of, you know, people are dying, everyone's life has value, and, you know, we're not going to wait till it becomes more socially acceptable to talk about for whatever reason.
Andrea, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm going to put something else on the table here having to do with the creation of a database. There have been some calls, and this, I guess, has to do with prescription medicine for painkillers, to create a database so that doctors, I guess, can load in information about their patients and then can track if people, I guess, are abusing or overusing these drugs. Noni, where does this have any traction in Pennsylvania?
Well, yes, we do have a drug monitoring program. One of the criticisms is that the doctors do not have to participate in it or record their prescriptions.
It's voluntary, I guess.
Right. What they do have to do, though, is look up what if the patient is using, but they do not have to report when they prescribe. I think it's more successful with the pharmacists. So there, some people criticize the program for that. I understand Rose has a different point of view. I think that as far as addiction is concerned, on the whole, we need our medical community to be much, much more aware of addiction as a disease and to actually study it in their courses as they're becoming doctors. Mm-hmm. So anything that we do to start raising the awareness of doctors to the consequences of not paying attention is very important.
You do have a different point of view, Roseanne.
Well, I just think we have to be careful with these databases, especially depending on what you're talking about. If you're talking about letting law enforcement have access to people's medical records, we certainly have some qualms with that. I also think we can't see it as a panacea. In Massachusetts, after they implemented their database and with a lot of restrictions, what happened was they did see a slight decrease in deaths related to prescription opioids, but deaths related to heroin use increased 50%. And,
wow.
You know, a similar cautionary tale is with OxyContin when it was reformulated. And you can certainly say there was a lot of irresponsible marketing of OxyContin and prescribing of OxyContin. But when it was finally reformulated to make more tamper-resistant, you know, again, you saw maybe a 20% decrease in OxyContin abuse. You saw a 50% increase in heroin abuse because people switched. Getting rid of one particular opioid doesn't necessarily reduce the overall harms that opioids can cause.
So what do you do? I mean, if that's the issue, if you try to at least regulate or monitor the prescription drugs and make it harder, and then you see an increase in the use of heroin, for instance, what is a policy that would work?
Well, I certainly think doctors need more education on pain management. Opioids are not necessarily the answer for every form of pain, although we want to make sure that people who really need them and for whom they're effective do have access to them. We don't want people dying in pain. We don't want people living in pain or being disabled. You know, I also think, again, looking at what are our goals. If our goals are to reduce deaths from opioids, you know, a lot of the individuals who are using them, again, are people who may be casually using them, who may be combining them with alcohol or other drugs like benzodiazepines. And so getting education out there, one of the things, you know, we've had a real problem in this country traditionally is we've taken a just say no approach as opposed to saying, you know, people are going to use these drugs and how do we keep them from being harmed by them? How do we keep them from dying? And I think that's the most important thing, keeping people alive.
Indeed. Noni, and then we'll get to our calls.
I would just like to add to what Rose is saying is this is not just a policy issue. This is everybody's problem, and it becomes a community issue. So the education, what we do in our communities, the attitude of our law enforcement, the policies that our legislators work on all need to work together.
Let me get, looks like Chris from Phoenixville to join our conversation. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Long-time listener, first time actually being able to call in.
Good for you, Chris. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm ex-military. I was in the Marine Corps. I got injured in the military. And my injury caused them to give me, obviously, pain medication. Now, the pain medication slightly goes more and more. I start taking more and more for the pain. And eventually, long story short, I make my way towards heroin. Due to the fact that I couldn't get any more of the prescription. They started costing too much. That was a big thing, was the price. Now, I'm 2 years clean.
Good for you.
I went through NA at first. NA was a program that tells you that you're an addict for life. Now, that's something I couldn't agree with. I sort of went to Smart Recovery in the middle of going to NA, and Smart Recovery was a very, very, very good, logical, and very good. It really tapped into, like, common sense almost, like how to think. It changes your whole way of thinking. And to everyday life. I mean, there's things now that I use in Smart Recovery that just help me make decisions for my life. And it was really, really, really good.
You know, Chris, I hate to interrupt here, but you don't have the greatest phone line. But we understand what you're saying. First of all, congratulations for getting off of heroin 2 years ago. You talked about NA, and then you talked about cognitive therapy. I mean, a way of sort of thinking about how you're thinking and helping yourself think your way through various challenges, I'm sure, that you do face. Chris, let me just give Roseanne Scotty a chance to respond. You're nodding your head there, Roseanne.
Well, I think Chris makes a great point. You know, treatment or recovery, there's no one size fits all. Different things work for different people, just as with any other medical condition in terms of, you know, mental health issues, whatever it would be. And I think the point is to, you know, for us to assess people realistically and have evidence-based approaches and help people and support people in what works best for them achieving their goals.
And Noni, what I hear from both of you is that there is no one-size-fits-all. Yes, you can go to NA, you can go to other treatment facilities, but finding, I guess, the treatment that is going to work for the individual, that's probably a pretty big challenge.
Yes. I'm thinking of a quote from Tom McClellan that I was at in Washington, America Honors Recovery. And at the end, he said, I think it was Bill White said to him that...
Bill White of AA, right?
Bill White, no, he's an historian.
Okay.
An addiction and has studied addiction. And he said, you can recover from diabetes, but addiction is the one disease that you can recover from and come out a better person.
Ah. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think it depends upon the group and the program that you're moving with.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let me see what Ian from Collingswood has to say. Ian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, back in 1968, when I became a public defender, there was, at that very moment, a raid on drug deliverers, and there were 45 people arrested. And at that time, the chief of police announced that the drug war in Camden had been won and there would be no more drugs in Camden.
Mm.
In fact, we haven't learned very much either from the laws of prohibition or from criminalization of drugs. I just believe that criminalization of drugs... And this doesn't, I don't support the use of heroin or crack cocaine or whatever, but the criminalization actually makes our situation worse than better. It refocuses on arresting people, throwing them in prison, rather than dealing with psychological, physical, medical issues. And I still believe that it is time for us to do away with criminalization and deal with the actual problem of whatever prompts a person to use a drug that is bad for their health. And I thought I'd mention it.
Well, I'm glad you did. And actually, before the show began, I predicted your phone call, not your specific phone call, but someone raising this particular issue. Noni, you want to respond?
What I would like to say is in Pennsylvania, our Secretary of Correction is trying to address those issues because he doesn't want more people in prison and is looking at what happens. He has asked the counties, actually, to do an assessment before they get to prison. So the state prisons, so that they can do the proper take the proper kind of approach so that there is less recidivism.
We're almost out of time here. I'm looking at a piece that was in NJ Spotlight about Governor Christie basically saying the death of a close friend, apparently from a combination of drugs and alcohol, recently led Governor Chris Christie to emphasize his concern about reducing overdose deaths in the state. And often it does take a personal experience to help someone, in this case, looks like the governor, change their position on some issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And the governor has been very open about talking about people in his life who've had addiction problems. I think the reason that we have a naloxone law in New Jersey and a Good Samaritan law is because we worked with a huge group of parent advocates who talked about losing loved ones, particularly children, and it just helped to change legislators' minds. It helped to change the public's mind because people thought, you know, what if that was me? What if that was my child, my loved one? How would I want them to be approached on this? How would I want them to be treated? And so personal experience really, especially in terms of a situation like drug use, which is so stigmatized and so marginalized, is a key to getting people to really understand what we need to do and shift their thinking.
On that note, my thanks to the two of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Roseanne Scotti, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She is the Drug Policy Alliance's State Director in New Jersey. Noni West, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she's Public Policy and Family Program Specialist for the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Twitter, Facebook, email, archives, and how to hear us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.